Welcome to a series of podcasts from the Irish Linen Centre and Lisburn Museum. In these podcasts, we talk to historians, journalists, authors, and community practitioners, and invite them to share their research, their love of museums, and their thoughts on the role museums play in society. This podcast has been made possible with the generous support from Lisburn and Castlereagh City Council. Hello and welcome to our next episode of the Winter Talk series, and joining me today, journalist and historian Ronan McGreevy. Ronan, you're very welcome to
Thanks
the Lisburn
very much,
Museum.
Barry. Thank you for having me.
Tonight you're going to be speaking about Henry Wilson,
yes.
The subject of your last book.
Yes.
Can you tell us briefly, for people who don't know, who Henry Wilson was and what attracted you to this topic?
Well, he was an Irishman. He was originally from Kerrygrain, County Longford. He would have been of sort of gentry stock, Anglo-Irish stock. He joined the British Army as a young man and rose to the highest rank, which was the Chief of the Imperial General Staff, a role he had at the end of the First World War. So he was credited in many ways as one of the men who won the war. He had his chief role during the war was to liaise with the other allies, and which he did particularly with the French and the Americans towards the end of the war, and that brought Germany to terms in November 1918 with the armistice. So he was a very popular figure, a very well-known figure in the UK up to the end of the First World War. He carried on as chief of the Imperial General Staff until February 1922. But he became estranged from the British government. He was a unionist, Southern unionist, but somebody who very much identified with the Northern tradition. He opposed the Irish government, the British government's policy of dealing with Sinn Féin. He opposed the establishment of the Irish Free State. And in February 1922, he became an Ulster Unionist MP, and he held that role until June 1922. In terms of why I'm interested in this story, I think it's a really fascinating story. It's very much an All-Ireland story. His death had catastrophic implications for the South, the 26-county state that was established, as his death was an immediate trigger for the Civil War in Ireland. But he died really, he was regarded in the North here as basically the first martyr of Northern Ireland. He had become an advisor to the military advisor to James Craig's government in 1922. He had been associated unfairly, in my view, associated publicly in the minds of a lot of nationalists with state repression against the Catholic minority in the North, and that cost him his life.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there 1922. That was a huge year for Ireland. What impact did his killing, and you touched on it a bit, did that have on British-Irish relations?
Well, I described his death as Ireland's Sarajevo, just as the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in 1914 leads on 37 days later to the First World War. The Wilson shooting leads on immediately 6 days later to the outbreak of the Irish Civil War. To cut a long story short, when Wilson was killed, the British government was shocked. He was shot dead on the streets of London outside his home in 36 Eaton Place by two IRA men, Reggie Dunn and Joe Sullivan. And the British government was absolutely horrified by this killing, and they blamed the anti-treaty IRA for the killing. They blamed the treaty rebels that were holed up and had occupied the forecourts in Dublin since April of 1922. So they gave Michael Collins an ultimatum: either deal with the anti-treaty rebels or we will. And the Irish government had its back to the wall and decided to open fire on the forecourts, and that started the Irish Civil War.
There have been several studies of Wilson in the past. Yours is different in that it deals primarily with his assassination. In recent years, you probably know more than most, the unveiling of a lot of digitized resources.
Yes.
How important were they in
massively
your work?
Important to me in terms of, basically, Irish historians are busy rewriting the accounts of Irish history because of the release of the military service pension collection files. These are files of former IRA volunteers, Cumann na mBan, etc., etc., who had fought in the War of Independence or in the Easter Rising, who had to give an account for their actions. So what we have from those accounts are various different accounts of this shooting that I've never seen the light of day before. We have the accounts of Joe O'Sullivan's brother Pat. We have the accounts of Dennis Keller, who was supposed to have been the third man in relation to the shooting but didn't turn up, and various different documents that I have turned up from various different sources have helped illuminate this story. There was a book published on the assassination in 1961 by Rex Taylor, but he didn't have the access that we have nowadays to digitize records. So I mean, we're in the process of a tremendous democratization of historical records nowadays, and it's really transforming scholarship, certainly Irish historical scholarship in terms of the decade of centenary. So it's very important for my book.
I think it'd be fair to say that part of your book looks at maybe the afterlife of conflict. So yeah. Wilson's life after World War One, but also yeah. his assassins were in World War One as well.
Yeah, this is what I mean. One of the many angles that I have that drew me to this story, and one of the many interesting things about it is that Wilson was an Irish-born British imperialist killed by two British-born Irish nationalists, and I found that very, very interesting. I lived in London for a long time, so I have some knowledge of London Irish identity. So Wilson, though he was born, particularly he was born in the south of Ireland, he was born in Lawford, he identified with British imperialism. The two guys who killed him identified with Irish nationalism, but both of them had served in the First World War, and both were injured. Reggie Dunn, his left kneecap was shattered. Joe Sullivan lost his right leg at Passchendaele. So in essence, like, if you had rewound the clock 5 years previously, Wilson, Reggie Dunn and Joe Sullivan were all on the same side. But then they had become radicalised in London by the IRA. Both Dunn and O'Sullivan were sworn into the IRA in 1919. But more importantly for my story, they were also sworn into the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which was a secret organisation, unlike the IRA, which was an open organisation. And that's an important part of the story. So I found that aspect of things really, really interesting, the whole concept of Irish identity.
Yeah, that's really interesting. But also, I suppose, World War One is the big factor here, and the aftermath of World War One. In the museum here, they have a VATS exhibition, which deals with the return to civilian life and stuff. What do you think the role of museums is in telling stories like this?
Well, I think they have two roles. One is the sort of permanent exhibition whereby you remind people constantly, and you have a turnover of visitors that come here to see this. The other thing is to keep that memory alive through events like this, and temporary exhibitions and exhibitions which correspond with centenaries and that. But I guess now that the First World War centenary is well over, I think it's important to keep doing that. And I just heard a discussion on the news agents there with this former BBC presenters contest, and they were talking to the producer of the All Quiet on the Western Front, this new German movie that's out. It's fantastic. I'd recommend it to everybody. And they were talking about how, you know, memory of the First World War comes and goes. It fades out. And particularly in Germany, whereby they don't think about the First World War at all because it's completely eclipsed by the horrors of the Second. But now, you know, that this movie's out, there's a much greater interest in the First World War. And I think, in fairness, like in Ireland, and I mean, I'm talking about the island here, there's been a huge upsurge in interest in the First World War. And I think a lot of the museums in the south, like Collins Barracks and the National Library of Ireland, had a permanent exhibition for over four years. I think they've done a great job in resurrecting the memory of the First World War in the sort of south, which was not like here where it's a central part of the identity. It was kind of hushed up a bit.
What do you see in terms of museums across the island and how they've come to the fore in this last decade?
I think they've behaved splendidly. One of the goals of the expert advisory group is for a greater understanding without taking sides, trying to understand why people made the decisions that they made 100 years ago instead of condemning those decisions. And I can see that here. I can see that in museums all over Ireland, big and small, where, you know, nowadays we're trying to understand the motivations of people 100 years ago. And the other thing, I guess, is that museums are an antidote to this desire to weaponize history or to weaponize the telling of history for partisan ends. Again, I was listening to a podcast there about how Putin was using the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Stalingrad to say that basically the invasion of Ukraine was in some ways a continuity with the Soviet Union struggle against German Nazism. I mean, it's just not true, you know. Yeah. So I think museums like this are very important in getting, you know, getting people like myself and others to come here and to talk about. I mean, you know, we have so. One of the things I find, particularly with the First World War, is that this is an all-Ireland story. There is no, it's a story that both parts of Ireland can share. It's part of our shared experience. We were all on the one side 100 years ago. So I think this stories like the Wilson is in a kind of similar vein. It's a story that both parts of Ireland can share, because it's very much impacted on both.
Yeah. My final question: you're an expert on Henry Wilson. Mm. If you were to curate an exhibition about Wilson's life, could you pick one item that you would include in an exhibition?
I've just come from. You showed me a wonderful photograph of Henry Wilson that was that's in the cathedral here, mm-hmm. Which is from his wife, and it's to the Lisburn Cathedral, and she's remembering in January 9, 2022 that Wilson came here to unveil the statue of Nicholson. And that, you know, 11 months later he's dead. And it's just like, that was a real gut punch for me to see that. I never saw that before. And this always happens when you write a book. The minute you write a book, you go, somebody comes forward and they say, oh, I've got this and that. In fact, the paperback version of my book, which is coming out in May, is different to the original, because I have significant new information relating to Michael Collins's involvement, I believe his involvement in the shooting. But that would probably be something that I would include. And I've got letters as well from that are in the National Library of Ireland from Reginald Dunne that he wrote to his mother before he died. And they are works of, dare I say, literature. I mean, this is what's interesting about these two characters who killed Wilson. I mean, they were obviously condemned at the time as low class sort of thugs and terrorists and so on. They're actually very, I don't agree with what they did, by the way, but they were very thoughtful young men. And it does give you, it gives you some insight into, you know, the sort of the extremist mind at that stage. So I guess if I was one thing, it would be this photograph you showed me, but I think the Reggie Dunne letters would be interesting too.
Ronan, thanks very much for joining me today. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you, Barry. Okay. Really appreciate it. Okay.